We look back at our month-long coverage of the Black Hills National Forest. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, August 31st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, COVID-19 cases are spiking in South Dakota. We welcome Dr. Chad Turry from Avera Medical Group to talk about what that means for hospitals. Community leader Vani Harari joins us to talk about the new Ken Burns documentary, Ali. SDPB will be screening the film tomorrow night in both our Sioux Falls and Rapid City studios. Masks are required. Plus, a new exhibit opening this Friday allows South Dakota artists to explore what this state means to them. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio. I'm Megan Feary, filling in for Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. House lawmakers continue to call on Attorney General Jason Roundsburg to step down from his position. Roundsburg took a plea deal following his involvement in an accident that took the life of a Hyde County resident. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
Attorney General Jason Roundsburg pleaded no contest last week to a pair of driving-related misdemeanors after he fatally hit pedestrian Joe Beaver last year. Republican Representative Will Mortensen brought articles of impeachment against Roundsburg during the last legislative session. House Republicans held off on the articles until Roundsburg's trial could take place. Now, Mortensen says the best outcome would be for Roundsburg to step down from his position.
And you've heard from about every law enforcement group that he should leave office, and you've heard from the executive branch a couple of times on that same note. Those are the two entities that the Attorney General's office is really supposed to serve and interface with the most. I continue to believe that'd be the best outcome for our state.
Mortensen says legislative leadership will decide whether to bring articles of impeachment against Roundsburg. Governor Kristi Noem says Roundsburg has not accepted responsibility for killing Joe Beaver. She's handing over investigative materials to House Speaker Spencer Gosch. Democratic Representative Jamie Smith is the leader of House Democrats. He says the event was a tragedy where a man lost his life.
The charges that were filed, misdemeanors, a plea deal, doesn't seem to us like there was accountability taken there, and just some of his comments and what his attorney said just didn't show a real remorse, perhaps.
In a written statement, Roundsburg says he does not plan to resign. He says he's, quote, very sorry Joe Beaver lost his life in this accident. Roundsburg's first term ends next year. If he runs for re-election, he'll have at least one opponent for the Republican nomination. Former Attorney General Marty Jackley says he's running for the job. I'm SDPB's Lee Strubinger.
South Dakota lawmakers tasked with redrawing the state's political boundaries have set a framework that will allow them to speed through the once-in-a-decade process on a tight schedule this year. The two committees responsible for drawing the new legislative districts began their work in earnest on Monday after the U.S. Census Bureau released detailed data earlier this month. Lawmakers only have about 10 weeks to propose districts before a special session of the legislature convenes on November 8th. Republican lawmakers cited the shortened process in setting two parameters that will guide their work, but one Democrat says he wants to slow things down. After a pair of losses over the weekend, South Dakota is the fourth-place finisher in this year's Little League World Series. South Dakota lost 5-2 against Michigan in the semifinals and 5-0 against Hawaii in the third-place game. There will be a welcome home ceremony for the team Wednesday evening at the Sanford Sports Complex in Sioux Falls. This year's fourth-place finish is the best for any South Dakota team in the history of the event. The state has qualified 4 previous times. In today's weather, we have highs in the 80s in the west and northeast, 70s in the southeast, with lows in the 60s across the board. Expecting widespread areas of haze and smoke in the west, with sunny skies and breezy conditions. Sunny skies in the northeast, and cloudy skies do gradually become more sunny in the southeast. Going into tonight, widespread haze and areas of smoke with increasing cloud cover in the west and mostly clear skies in the east. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Megan Feary in today for Lori Walsh. Since yesterday, there have been two more deaths from COVID-19 and over 1,000 new active cases in the state. 216 people are currently hospitalized. South Dakota has not seen that many people hospitalized from COVID since January. So what does this mean for our hospitals and their staff? Dr. Chad Turry is a family medicine physician and regional director of clinical quality with Avera Medical Group in Sioux Falls. He joins us on the phone to discuss just that. Dr. Turry, welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
Yes, absolutely. Just jumping right in, can you give us an overview of what you're seeing right now as far as hospitalizations are concerned?
Yeah, so certainly over the last couple of weeks, seeing an increase in hospitalizations. I think from our system, we're probably not quite triple hospitalizations that we had in early August. So seeing some increased numbers. It's stabilized a little bit, or the rate of increase hasn't been going up here the last number of days like we maybe anticipated. So we're kind of in a wait and see standpoint, but certainly numbers are going up.
And I think one of the bigger questions is, why is this happening? We're seeing case numbers and hospitalization numbers that we haven't seen since January. And, that was before the vaccine was available. And now the vaccine is available. It's free. It's available to everyone. So I guess the big question is, why?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. We're doing pretty well here as far as vaccination rates. We're probably in the middle of the pack as far as states in the Sioux Falls region and some other counties throughout the state. We're doing a little better job compared to some other counties. So I think our vaccination rates are helping to some degree. But the Delta variant is really the game changer here that we're dealing with. So despite being vaccinated, vaccinations are still very effective as far as preventing hospitalizations, preventing death. It's the best tool we have to fight this virus, but we do end up seeing a little more breakthrough infections with the Delta variant. I think some recent study I looked at was maybe about a 70% effectiveness rate compared to, the initial studies that came out regarding the COVID vaccinations and how they were about 90-95% effective in preventing symptomatic disease. So I think some breakthrough cases there. I think the summer months we're outside more. School's not in place. We're not doing as many large kind of social gatherings. And I think some of that has changed here over the last month, which has probably contributed to the increase in case rates as well.
So I'm fully vaccinated and everyone here is fully vaccinated. How worried do I have to be about ending up in the hospital?
So I really think that depends on, kind of your underlying health status. So I think a fully vaccinated person that's, young and otherwise healthy is still going to do really good. If there's considerable degree of immune compromise and you haven't been able to get your third booster shot, then you probably need to be careful because there is a chance that despite being fully vaccinated, you're going to could end up in the hospital. So I think if in that situation with someone that's immune compromised, maybe older age, and has some of those higher risk factor diseases such as COPD and diabetes and so on, then if you are going to be out, it really makes sense to wear a mask. And I think, going back to just CDC guidelines and in general mitigation measures for everybody, if you're out in public and certainly in places where it's indoors and you can't socially distance, you should be wearing a mask anyways.
So kind of going back to the basics where we were a year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of hard to talk about cases going up and hospitalization rates going up without talking about the difference maybe that we're seeing between the eastern side of the state and the western side of the state. Can you tell me how you guys are doing in comparison to how we're doing out here in the West River?
Yeah, I think we're comparatively doing a little bit better. Going back to a lot of those different variables as far as what can impact that rise in COVID cases. So comparatively, once again, I think on the western side of the state and around Rapid City, there's probably a little bit lower vaccination rates compared to other parts of the state, including in particular Minnehaha County. So that contributes, obviously, the number of visitors coming into the area out there from the Sturgis rally is going to impact those case numbers going up as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'd really love to know, well, how is your hospital staff doing? You know, how has this affected their mental health? How is everyone holding up?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You know, certainly it's been a rough last 18 months dealing with COVID. There was a little bit of a reprieve here during the summer months as far as COVID cases, but everything else was busy. So all the other things that come in as far as surgical procedures and trauma and so on, I mean, the hospitals never really kind of got that summer slowdown or late summer slowdown. So we've been pushing through, and now you add a little bit of a COVID surge on top again. So, you know, really trying to boost the morale of staff and encourage them to continue to push forward. But certainly burnout is a big issue. And unfortunately, we've had some staff that have left healthcare because of COVID over the last 18 months. And so we've kind of got some holes to fill in regards to staffing because of that as well.
Absolutely. So wash your hands, wear a mask, socially distanced, and I'm guessing most importantly, get vaccinated?
That is correct. Kind of the same story, same messaging, just you know, making sure that we're doing it. It you know, we're gonna see a surge here, and the month of September could be a little rough, but you're right. There's burnout in the hospitals. I know everybody's kind of tired of COVID, but the reality is we've got Delta here to deal with over the next 4 to 6 weeks, and we need to all do our part as far as mitigating that surge and impacting our hospital loads. And once again, the hospitals, we're going to be able to manage it, but we got to be able to have the staffing ratios and stuff like that to be able to manage all the other everyday things that we deal with. You know, looking back to last year, we ended up shutting things down for a while and pushing some services back, and that just kind of led to a bottleneck. So we want to make sure that we're still providing all the routine, everyday things that we need to do and deal with COVID on top of it. And we're going to need all the help we can get from the community to decrease the rate of COVID infections and COVID-related hospitalizations.
Absolutely, without a doubt. Well, thank you to all the healthcare workers and hospital staff. And thank you, Dr. Chad Turry, for joining us today on In the Moment.
No problem. Thank you.
Ahead on the program, one South Dakota family did something a little different with their oat crop this year. Laura Rohde has that story for SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
I'm Julie Rose. Join me for a special Labor Day episode of Top of Mind. Americans are working more and more hours, and the pandemic virtually obliterated the line between work and home. Are we due for a new labor revolution, this time focused on working less? Plus, we'll hear about the trend of digital nomads taking remote work to extremes. It's Top of Mind.
Listen Labor Day at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility. Advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR, here to thank sustaining members of this station. Public Radio is here for you every day, no matter what. And when you give automatically every month, you continually show that you're here for us and for this community. Thank you so much for your support.
Monthly sustaining supporters form a strong foundation for SDPB. Sustaining donations are ones SDPB can count on to fund programs you love. Thank you.
Program funding by Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Megan Feary, in today for Lori Walsh. Since 1882, the Sumption family has farmed near Frederick, South Dakota. It's a community just 28 miles north of Aberdeen. Until recently, their fifth-generation crop and cattle farm was pretty typical. SDPB's Lura Rohde visits with Taylor and Cassie Sumption about how the family is adding value to the oats they raise.
The Sumption family wrapped up the 2021 oat harvest early August, and instead of delivering oats to the local elevator, they are doing something a bit different this year. After harvest, the family has their oat bushels processed, packaged, and then they will market them direct to consumers online or to grocery stores as Anthem Oats, an instant flavored oatmeal.
If you look over time, you know that the value of the food dollar that the farmer gets is just steadily shrinking, and it's frustrating. And that was really where the idea was born, is to, you know, try to find ways to add value to what we're doing. I've said it a lot, I think the future of the family farmer hinges on value-added agriculture, finding ways to add value to what we grow here, keep those jobs here, keep those plants here. That's the future of the family farmer.
Since childhood, Taylor Sumption has farmed and raised cattle with his dad, John, and four brothers. Today, some of the sixth generation have also joined the family farm. To support the families who rely on it for their income, Sumption Farms has increased crop acres and cattle numbers. When he began developing Anthem Oats as a way to add value to Sumption Farms, Taylor relied on his wife, Casey, to help him work through the details.
It's been awesome working with Taylor. It's something that we never saw ourselves doing, but it's just wonderful to bounce ideas off one another. Even when we go home at night, we're always talking and coming up with new ideas on how to make this a better adventure for not just our family, but for the community and everyone that buys our products.
The Sumptions also worked with product development consultants and marketing experts.
There's a lot. There's a lot of moving parts. The supply chain, logistics, all of those little moving parts, they're a big struggle. There's a lot of regulatory hurdles in any food product for safety. So there's, on your own, it would be a really hard endeavor. We enlisted the help of some consultants and other companies to help pull all those pieces together.
Anthem Oats is intentionally headquartered on Sumption farmland just west of the Frederick ball fields.
A couple reasons, I think one was to stay authentic to our brand, that we're a local farm and that we have our company right here where our farm is located. The other one, I love our community, and my hope is that we can add jobs and be productive members here in our own hometown.
Even the oats they raise for Anthem Oats cereal are South Dakota based.
And we've got a great university. South Dakota State has a really intensive oat breeding program. They've done a great job, developing oat lines that are good for milling, feed, different uses and stuff. So they're a really good resource to source oat varieties for milling.
8 years after Taylor Sumption originally came up with the idea, Anthem Oats are now available on grocery store shelves or for purchase online. Connecting with consumers is yet another benefit of selling their oats as oatmeal instead of trucking them to the local elevator.
You know, when you raise corn and soybeans, you don't get a real connection with that end user, and that's one thing with Anthem that's been very fulfilling to me, is that you get feedback from people, you get to hear some, real heartwarming stories about how their family ate your oatmeal, and that connection has been just awesome. It's something I never really thought of when we started this, and it's probably one of the most fulfilling things about starting something like this.
Marketing their oats direct to consumers and retailers increases the per bushel value of oats by about 250%. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lura Rohde.
SDPB's Lura Rohde visits with Taylor and Cassie Sumption about how the family is adding value to the oats they raise. If you are a South Dakotan looking for ways to add value, Taylor Sumption recommends reaching out to the South Dakota Value Added Agriculture Department Center. You can find a link to the website at sdpb.org/news. After the break, we wrap up our August spotlight with a capstone of the month's coverage. This is In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a series of soul music interviews from our archive. We start with Aretha Franklin, who's currently being portrayed by Jennifer Hudson in the new biopic Respect, and Jerry Wexler, who produced Aretha's recordings on the Atlantic label, including Respect. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, promoting reading for all ages with the 2021 Young Readers One book, Imagine Imahina, by Juan Felipe Herrera, featuring English and Spanish text. More at sdhumanities.org.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Megan Feary, in for Lori Walsh. The Black Hills National Forest is changing. Years of damage from wildfires and pine beetles have shifted the conversation about the sustainability of the forest and the viability of the forest products industry. This month, the SDPB Spotlight coverage has focused on the forest. Here's Lori Walsh with a recap.
In order to begin to understand the Black Hills, you need to spend some time there. For me, the forest sounds a little different every time I visit. It's muffled once and ringing the next. One time, I sat in silence for an hour or more and never heard another footstep. Other times, I've been in the Black Hills and heard rustling and rumbling, even a disquiet. But the forest always seems to smell exactly like I remember it does, sweet and fragrant and blanketed with pine. Well, the story of this place is a complicated one, so hold on for the ride today. We're going to begin at a beginning with an origin story. Here's Daryl Redcloud. He's an interpreter at Crazy Horse Memorial in Custer. I asked him to tell me the story of the Great Race, which takes place on the so-called racetrack, which is this reddish ring-shaped depression that surrounds the interior of the Black Hills. Here's Daryl Redcloud.
Our people, they go back and they say that our origin story, they say we come from the great spiritual realm into this spiritual realm within the Black Hills through a place called Wind Cave. Onia Waka, they say in our language. And there they say that everything existed in harmony with one another, all the animals and the beings of different kinds, including mankind. And there was a great race that happened around the Black Hills, and everything ran on the black on this great racetrack, and to see who was going to become the dominant species. And all the animals, the insects of different kinds, the winged, the two-legged, even the four-legged, the pawed, the hoofed animals, they all ran on this great racetrack all the way around. And as they were coming to the end, and then the buffalo was in lead, very strong. And just as he was ready to cross the line, they say that the magpie that sat on his hump behind his ear flew across the line and won the race for the two-legged and the winged. And after everything settled down, then the magpie called upon mankind. Mankind, we would like to honor you today to become the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth. Since you have a bigger brain than we do, since you understand Creator's way, about his spiritual place, that we must exist in harmony with all of creation. So mankind steps up and he takes that honor. From then on, mankind became the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth.
Now, we're going to jump forward to the beginnings of the United States of America, not long before gold is discovered and exploited within the Black Hills. What was then referred to popularly as the Great Sioux Nation is the dominant tribe of the Black Hills. Craig Howe is founder and director of the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. Here he is explaining some key points of U.S. Supreme Court cases and treaties that impacted the Black Hills and the Native people who live there.
The first one basically said that American Indians have occupancy rights to the land, but they don't really own it. The analog I use is just like a deer or a bear or an elk. You know, they occupy the land, but they cannot alienate it in and of themselves. They can't pass it on, and they have no ownership claim to it. That's essentially what the United States decision in 1823 said. And that if American Indians want to alienate their rights to that land in any way, the only entity they can do that to is the United States of America. So it limited the leverage or the negotiating power of American Indians. They didn't have this way of playing the United States off against other nations in the world, as far as bidding for land or with states or with individual Americans. That all that was prohibited. Tribes could only alienate their land to the United States. In the 1832 decision, that's where the decision was made that American Indian tribes have inherent rights. Mm. So these are the rights of these tribes and their citizens prior to the United States. These are inherent rights. They're not given to tribes. And so by 1832, then, U.S. law recognizes that these tribes have these inherent rights prior to the establishment of the United States and not given to them by the United States. So the first treaty then that Lakotas or the Sioux Nation signed was in 1851, and that was the first Fort Laramie Treaty. And that treaty was basically a treaty of friendship between Plains tribes. And the United States was just trying to get everyone to get along, right? But what they did do was demarcate the territories of these tribes. And so in that 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, the Black Hills are entirely within the lands of the Great Sioux Nation, or Lakota, as we would say today. 17 years later, there's the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, and those lands are expanded. The lands, and in this case, it's not a treaty of friendship between tribes. It's a treaty of between the United States and the Great Sioux Nation. And the United States essentially is suing for peace. They want the fighting between the United States and the Sioux Nation to end. And so they essentially sue for peace and then agree to all of the terms that the Sioux Nation, mostly represented by Lakotas, demanded. 1868 treaty lands had three statuses. There was the Great Sioux Reservation, there was the unceded territory, and then there was the hunting territory. Those are three land statuses that are encompassed or contained in that 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. And the Black Hills falls entirely within the Great Sioux Reservation.
Jump forward with me again. The Black Hills belongs, if you will, to Native people who use that forest for everything from food and water to ceremony and solace. European American explorers discover gold in the hills, and a great surge of prospectors and settlers and entrepreneurs floods into the land, ignoring treaties and boundaries. They extract gold and minerals. They take land and timber. Lots of timber. There's a real risk of permanent deforestation. Bill Coburn is from Spearfish, and he spent about 50 years in forestry. And here he is explaining that crisis and how the federal government's first timber sale happened.
After gold was discovered, you know, we had anywhere from 20 to 50,000 people descend into the Black Hills in the mid-1870s. And they were using wood for a lot of different things. And they pretty much, between 1876 and about the mid-1890s, late, you know, 1897, they figured over a billion board feet of timber was harvested out of the Black Hills. There's a lot of concern in the 1890s about deforestation, rampant logging. There wasn't any coal in the Black Hills, so a lot of these smelters that were being run to smelt gold down and ore were using wood. And so wood was being cut not only for timbers in the mines, but also railroad ties and fuel, and the smelters used probably the most of the timber to basically smelt the ore down to where they could get the gold out. And so in 1897, the president of the United States declared the non-patented lands of the Black Hills as a forest reserve, and that was supposed to put all these areas off line for being mined or logged or anything. Well, it created quite a furor. And so between 1897 and 1898, there was an act passed by the U.S. Congress called the Organic Act, and it basically allowed the forest reserves and the Department of Interior to sell timber off of these federal reserves. And that's where the case number one came into being, down by NEMO. Gifford Pinchot, who was working as an advisor to the Department of Interior, helped put this timber sale together, and they got it sold to Homestake Mining Company. It was for about 15 million board feet, and that was the beginning of timber sales for the National Forest. And then in about 1905, the forest reserves became the National Forest, and we ended up with the Black Hills National Forest.
Another big jump on our tour of history today. Let's look at what's happening right now, because many forest lovers believe we are once again at a pivotal crossroads. The Black Hills National Forest, the origin of the Lakota people, the origin of the United States' first federal government timber sale, and the origin of today's story, that forest has changed, and we have changed it. Massive wildfires like the 2001 Jasper Fire and the most recent pine beetle epidemic have also shifted the nature of the forest itself. Here is Jim Furnish. He's the former chief deputy of the U.S. Forest Service.
I'd start by saying I was a little shocked to learn that in 2019, the Black Hills National Forest, out of 150 national forests nationwide, harvested more timber than any other in the U.S. That was mind-blowing to me. This is not the Pacific Northwest. It's good timber country, but that made me think, what's going on? It was one of the reasons, I think, with the Trump administration, where we saw such a focus on trying to restore commercial utilization of a lot of our natural resources. People think of oil and gas and logging, and that type of thing is emblematic of that. But there was something happening on the Black Hills that really caught my attention, and was just shocked to see some of the timber harvesting practices that were occurring there recently. The Forest Service, thankfully, a research branch, completed this general technical report that took a whole look at what was the volume of timber, how much harvesting was going on, what was happening with things like fires in the Black Hills, the bark beetle epidemic, and all this kind of thing, to reach the general conclusion that the logging that was occurring now is simply unsustainable. And I'm talking like magnitudes of three times as much. So they've been harvesting up to 200,000 100 cubic feet And the general technical report said that they needed to be like at 60,000 or less to be really sustainable. And my thought was that that 60,000 level is really returning the Black Hills more to the type of logging when I was there, and more recently even in the 1990s and that type of thing. So what had stimulated this huge ramp up? And a lot of it was associated with salvage logging of some fires and also the bug mortality. They were harvesting dead trees, but they were also very aggressively mining the green timber, the live standing timber. And then to see the way in which they were doing it with these huge overstory removals where they were taking out all the biggest trees and this kind of thing, I just thought, you know, this requires some response, some action on my part.
Let's talk about that Rocky Mountain Research Station General Technical Report. Well, in it, the scientists say that logging should be reduced by at least 50% in the Black Hills National Forest for the next several decades. The U.S. Forest Service is in the process of revising the current forest plan. The very idea of a reduction in logging, however, is controversial. Existing Forest Service logging restrictions have compelled Neiman Enterprises to close one of its three Black Hills sawmills, according to the company. That cost 120 jobs. The industry says it also reduces the ability of the Forest Service to manage the forest in the future. Here's Bill Coburn again.
In 2000, we had a fire, Jasper Fire, that burned 83,000 acres. In 2002, we had the Battle Creek Fire, 13,000 acres. We had the Grizzly Gulch Fire that burned well over 10,000 acres, and we had a lot of other fires that started basically taking out all these heavily stocked stands of forest. Mm-hmm. And the forest will not stay intact when it's overstocked. And you're going to see it either through natural processes like mountain pine beetle, other types of insects, disease, or fire, it'll start reducing those stocking levels.
Coburn also says the debate over logging recommendations is political and sometimes personal.
You know, I guess there's some differences of opinion, but what I really don't like right now, what's happening, Laurie, is that there are some who are trying to portray the industry as evil and wanting more and more. I know the industry. I worked in it for, you know, 50 years, basically. I started working for it out of high school, and caring people wanting to make sure what they're doing is sustainable for a long, long time, and they're not looking to over-harvest this forest by any means.
So here's what's at stake. If you harvest too much or you manage the forest poorly, you can destroy the diversity of the forest. You can even deplete the forest. If you harvest too little or you manage the forest poorly, you can create conditions for greater wildfires or further beetle outbreaks, and you can deplete the forest. Now, a working group for the Black Hills National Forest Advisory Board spent months poring over data from researchers in order to recommend sustainable logging levels for the next 5 years, while the Forest Service works on a new, longer-term master plan. That working group sent forward a recommendation that disagreed with the scientists' call for a reduction in logging and instead called for an increase of the cut. Two working group members gave a dissenting presentation, Carissa Bussey of the Nature Conservancy and our next guest, Bob Burns, with the South Dakota Family Forest Association. Burns says now is the time to pause and use caution, both in our actions and in our words.
Well, I would wish some of the entities would not be so vocal in public in their arguments. I really think this is something that we need to leave to the Forest Service and not be it a political basketball being thrown back and forth. The Forest Service is going to go through their plan. They'll get public input for the forest revision, and I think we need to wait and see how that turns out. Certainly everyone has a right to have input, and that's perfectly correct. It kind of gets to the point where you're drawing lines and positions are taken that may not be the best, I guess, you would say. One side says we have to go high, one side says we have to go low. But we need people, I think, of moderation that need to find the right answer. And things can change with another fire and another beetle outbreak.
Meanwhile, the forest has changed. The climate has changed. The way we talk to one another has changed. Still, we strive to compromise, to understand, to take this responsibility seriously as we grow toward an uncertain future. Public input on the current forest plan revision continues. We'll continue covering this story as well. You can find all our Spotlight coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. If you have more you want to add to this story, send me an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org.
That's our capstone of the August Spotlight, which was on the Black Hills National Forest. Let's take a moment now for the South Dakota Sports Almanac. SDPB's Nate Weck brings us this reoccurring series on profiles of South Dakota sports legends. Today's episode focuses on Olympic champion wrestler Randy Lewis.
He is known as the toughest kid on the block. Randy Lewis, a native of Rapid City, South Dakota, is one of the most physically gifted wrestlers in state history. Lewis attended Stevens High School, where he put forth one of the most impressive young resumes the state had ever seen, 89-0. Of those victories, 83 were by pins. And at age 18, he became the youngest ever to win the Junior World Championships. Lewis would go on to wrestle at the collegiate level for the University of Iowa, where he won two NCAA championships. In 1980, Lewis became the youngest member of the Team USA wrestling squad, but they never made the trip to Moscow that year for the Olympics because of President Carter's boycott of the games. Lewis would get another chance 4 years later for Team USA at the 1984 Olympic Games. In the final round, he defeated Kyoshi Akechi of Japan 24-11 to win the gold medal for the 136.5-pound weight class. To this day, Randy Lewis has one of the most decorated resumes of any wrestler to come out of the Mount Rushmore state.
Tomorrow night, we will welcome guests into both the Sioux Falls and Rapid City studios for a screening of the new Ken Burns documentary on boxer and activist Muhammad Ali. Community leader Vani Harari will be moderating those screenings and joins us next. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Scott Tong. As troops pull out of Afghanistan and evacuations wind down, we'll talk to historian Julian Zelizer and look back on the 20 years the U.S. has been involved there. Plus, we'll get the latest from the storm-ravaged Gulf Coast. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Toyota. See you at Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting is proud to announce the recipients of two National Edward R. Murrow Awards. Lee Strubinger is recognized for excellence in writing.
And they got the news they hoped they wouldn't.
And she was crying. And she said, Mom, he has COVID.
And Seth Tupper for investigative reporting.
Somewhat of a head scratcher to think about, well, how did it get there?
The only possible culprit was the fireworks.
Quality reporting about issues that matter are what you get here at SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Megan Feary in for Lori Walsh today. Vani Harari does a little bit of everything. He's an entrepreneur, community leader, and boxer, just to name a few. And tomorrow night, he'll be in our Sioux Falls studio for a special screening and discussion of the new Ken Burns documentary, Ali. He joins us by phone today. Vani, welcome to In the Moment.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I guess the biggest question is, what will you be discussing tomorrow?
We will be discussing all manner of things, because anybody that has any type of even peripheral knowledge of Muhammad Ali knows that he was a powerful, iconic figure with a lot of different facets. So we'll be talking a little bit about his growth and development, how he came to be a boxer, his boxing career and some of the major moments in that. But obviously a lot of that points to the history of who the man was, the icon was, the leader, the person who affected, you know, the country, the world in so many profound ways.
And what does Muhammad Ali mean to you? I've been told you know quite a bit about him.
Yeah, well, he's a powerful figure. I mean, obviously, as a lover of boxing, he is the greatest to me and most people. And the way he innovated boxing in terms of his style, you hadn't seen a heavyweight move in that type of way. You hadn't seen a heavyweight had that type of style. So he changed the way boxing worked, particularly for heavyweights. But the other thing was is he was pretty. You didn't see heavyweights that were that pretty and that charismatic and that good in front of the camera and in front of people. But the larger portion of it is what he meant for civil rights, what he meant for being able to have an identity of someone who is truly proud of their blackness, who is truly proud to be a black man in particular. That is something, you know, that we only saw from a few people at that time. Well, not a few. There was a lot of people. But we only got a chance to see so many people in front of our faces. And Muhammad Ali shined above most.
And I understand, you know, that might factor into some of the work that you do as well. Can you talk to me a little bit about your work and then tell me a little bit about your boxing career?
Yeah. So so for me, I do a lot of work in the social space. And my primary business is Think3D, as I think many of your listeners know. And we do leadership development and organizational culture consulting. One of the major things that I've done in this community for so much time is really working on social justice work, moving towards, you know, equity for everyone, representation for folks. And so as a person who came up from the remnants of what was civil rights and all that went into it, from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King to the Nation of Islam, to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to Muhammad Ali, and there's many, many, many other elements to that. That was our example of leadership. You know, those are the people that we saw. The unfortunate part about it is that many of the black leaders that we've had in our lives were assassinated. And so, you know, Muhammad Ali being one of those key figures that died from natural causes was a big deal. Just to be able to see one of these leaders reach old age and to be able to see him evolve as a person really inform what I do a lot and seeing the impact that you can make. And not only that, but the changes that they made over time, where they got. That's the beautiful part, is when you get to see somebody who started out maybe a little bit more brash, a little bit more frustrated, but as he developed, he widened the nets, he broadened the tents, he brought more people into it, and he was able to touch more people that way. And as far as me boxing, I would still put me on the side of recreational. And I would never, you know, use the word boxer in the same way that I would use it for Muhammad Ali or even some of the pro fighters that I know from around this area. But I'm an avid boxer. I've been doing it for many years in some capacity. But I have not competed in a way that most professional fighters have had the opportunity to compete. But I teach a little bit, and I hope a lot of those kind of fighters get ready for their fights.
Absolutely. So you would not step into the ring with Muhammad Ali is what I'm guessing.
Oh, that is absolutely not. No, I probably would just to be able to say that I stepped. I would get beat up just to be able to say that I stepped into the ring with Muhammad Ali.
You know, I might as well.
You know what I mean? I would want to know how hard he hit. I want to know how fast he moved. I would want to know how quick he was. I would want to feel it. And I would take that butt whooping just to have the experience to be in there with somebody so amazing at his craft.
Absolutely. Well, You, our listeners, you can join us in person at our Sioux Falls or Rapid City studios tomorrow night for those screenings. Masks are required, or you can watch online at sdpb.org/Ali, and you can see Vani Harari talk then. Thank you so much for joining us on In the Moment today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Looking forward to seeing you.
This Friday, a new art exhibit called Square Mileage asks artists what South Dakota means to them. Levi Sternberg is an event organizer with Untitled 10, and he joins us now by phone. Levi, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So glad to have you here. And, you know, for anyone who might not know, what is Square Mileage? What can people expect to see this Friday?
Square Mileage is an art show that Untitled 10 put together. We asked 50 artists to respond to the prompt, what does South Dakota mean to you, and to make a little square piece of art that responds to that. So we've got work from all different kinds of artists and all different media. So it's a unique experience and an art show everybody should definitely check out.
Yeah, and why did you choose, you know, this theme? Why did you ask artists this particular question?
Just like there's a lot of unoccupied square miles in the state of South Dakota, there's a lot of unoccupied intellectual space that we wanted to give young artists and new artists and emerging artists a chance to share what the state means to them.
Absolutely. You know, there's no shortage of open space in South Dakota, as I've discovered. But you know what? There's also no shortage of people doing incredible things here in the state.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I love that you're spotlighting that. That's incredible. And all the money being raised is being donated. Do I have that right?
Yeah, in a manner of speaking. We took a fee from every artist that entered the show, and all that will be donated to the Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute, which is an awesome program that does something really great for the next generation of artists in South Dakota. And a number of artists have chosen to donate a portion of their proceeds or all of their proceeds from the sale of their artwork to the camp as well.
That's fantastic. Now, are you an artist yourself?
Yeah, that's right.
What medium do you work in?
I work mostly in sculptures, but I made a painting for the show. A lot of artists in the show took this opportunity to make something a little different, try something new, or get back into something that they have sort of lost touch with. It's a unique opportunity for artists and for people to come see the show, and everybody's taking advantage of it in a very exciting way, unique way, you know.
Now, I know anyone who comes will be able to see your painting this Friday, but as a little preview, can you tell me a little bit about what does South Dakota mean to you and how it inspired the painting that you did for this exhibit?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm a huge advocate for institutional change in South Dakota. I wanted to imagine a better future, one that's more sustainable and equitable, and I made a little allegorical painting using animal figures to sort of play with that idea, to imagine a world like that.
And, you know, I think this past year, at least when the pandemic started, there was this idea that just great art was going to emerge out of this time of kind of collective trauma and what we were all experiencing. But a lot of artists I spoke to actually talked about the fact that they were just mentally and creatively drained from the pandemic. How did you find last year, and what did you hear from artists that you work with or speak to in the community?
It was definitely a difficult time for everybody, especially an artist. And it was difficult to get our communities together. That was, I think, the hardest part for us artists, was to be able to engage critically with our own work and with other people's work and to have conversations about it. I think that's like a real motivating factor, a real driving factor for a lot of artists. And that's why it's important to us to have receptions and do things where artists can get together and talk about artwork. And I think we all realize now how important that is, more than just as much as being in the studio making the stuff.
Is this going to be the first in-person event that you'll be attending?
No, not for me. Maybe for some people. There have been the art scene is sort of picking up again, has been picking up around Southeast Sioux Falls, and or Southeast South Dakota, anyway. So there has been some in-person programming, and that's been really brought a lot of life back into the community. We're just trying to do our part, make a little something happen too.
Now, this is going to take place at Rail Yard Flats in Sioux Falls. And as far as I understand, Rail Yard Flats is new, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's brand new, not even on Google Maps yet as of right now, but hopefully that'll change. But yeah, it's a brand new space. It's got a lot of stuff going on. There's an apartment section, office sections, and a bar, and a lobby where the artwork is going to be, mostly in that, in the lobby of the building. And it's a beautiful space, really great energy, great vibes, and some really beautiful art for its opening this weekend.
Well, that is just fantastic. I suppose since it's not on Google Maps, it's probably pretty important to give people the address. You can find Rail Yard Flats at 440 East 8th Street in Sioux Falls, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, right next to Monk's Ale House.
Yeah. And, you know, being in this space and this creative space in Sioux Falls, you know, how have you seen the artist community change over the years? I think you said it was growing and it's sort of flourishing and all these new things are coming out. You know, what have you seen?
I talk a lot about something I call the Heartland Renaissance, an idea that I believe in, where South Dakota and the middle of America specifically are becoming more and more important every day. More people are moving here, and things that we sort of didn't think we were, you know, we think about a big city having amenities that you wouldn't expect in South Dakota, but a lot of those things are coming here, and a lot of art and culture is coming with it.
Well, that is just wonderful to hear, really.
Yeah. So there are great things happening all over, and the people... Regular people are hungry to go out and see it, and creative people and artists are really excited to make it happen. So it's a great time to be here.
And if people come down, will masks be required this Friday?
I think masks are optional. If you're worried about exposure, the show will be up for 5 weeks after the 3rd, so plenty of opportunity for more intimate viewing of the space.
Well, thank you so much. Levi Sternberg, thank you for being with us today on In the Moment. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.